from Simon & Schuster Audio. Contact by Carl Sagan. Read by Jody Foster.
By human standards, it could not possibly have been artificial. It was the size of a world. But it was so oddly and intricately shaped, so cleverly intended for some complex purpose, that it could only have been the expression of an idea. Gliding in polar orbit about the great blue-white star, it resembled some immense imperfect polyhedron, encrusted with millions of bowl-shaped barnacles. Every bowl was aimed at a particular part of the sky. Every constellation was being attended to. The polyhedral world had been performing its enigmatic function for eons. It was very patient. It could afford to wait forever. When they pulled her out, she was not crying at all. Her tiny brow was wrinkled, and then her eyes grew wide. She looked at the bright lights, the white and green-clad figures, the woman lying on the table below her. On her face was an odd expression for a newborn. Puzzlement, perhaps. When she was 2 years old, she would lift her hands over her head and say very sweetly, "Dada, up!" His friends expressed surprise that the baby was so polite. "It's not politeness," her father told them. I said to her, "Ellie, you don't have to scream, just tell me. Kids are smart, right, Presh?" When she was 7, she took apart the old Motorola radio in the spare room. The radio was broken and had been retired some years before. Reinserting a tube and plugging the set in, she was delighted to see it begin to glow, and an ocean of static arose. She turned the knob marked frequency and came upon a voice talking excitedly about a Russian machine that was in the sky, endlessly circling the Earth. Endlessly, she thought. Her heart was beating, her palms were sweating. She thought about the inside of the radio. How did the voice and the music of the orchestras get in there? Was radio carried by the air? What is frequency? Why do you have to plug it in for it to work? Could you make a kind of map showing how the electricity runs through the radio? Later, in her favorite spot in the backyard, affecting a casual air when her mother walked by with the laundry, "Ellie, what have you been up to?" "Nothing, Mom. Just thinking." In her 10th summer, on vacation at a lake in Michigan, she walked down alone to the wooden pier one sultry moonless night. It was perfectly still. She looked up at the brilliant spangled sky and found her heart racing. She found a soft patch of grass and lay down. The sky was blazing with stars, thousands of them, most twinkling, a few bright and steady. If you looked carefully, you could see faint differences in color. The ground beneath her was solid and reassuring. This is all a big ball turning in the middle of the sky once a day with millions of people glued to it, talking different languages, wearing funny clothes, all stuck to the same ball. But if something as big as the Earth turned once a day, it had to be moving at an unbelievable speed. She thought she could now actually feel the Earth turn, not just imagine it, but really feel it in the pit of her stomach. It was like descending in a fast elevator. Gratifyingly, she was overtaken by the giddy sense that unless she clutched the clumps of grass on either side of her, she would fall up into the sky. When she was 11, her beloved father died, and everything changed. In the 7th grade, they were studying pi. It was a Greek letter that looked like the architecture at Stonehenge. If you measured the circumference of a circle and then divided it by the circle's diameter, that was pi. The teacher said that pi was about 3.1416. But if you wanted to be exact, it was a decimal that went on and on forever without repeating the pattern of the numbers. Forever, Ellie thought. She raised her hand.
How do you know? How can you count decimals forever?
Miss Arroway, this is a stupid question. You're wasting the class's time. Well, no one had ever called Ellie stupid before. She ran out of class sobbing. After school, she bicycled to the library at the nearby college to look through books on mathematics. If you knew something called calculus, you could prove formulas for pi that would let you calculate it to as many decimals as you had time for. She was determined to learn calculus. The book said that pi was a transcendental number. There was no equation with ordinary numbers in it that could give you pi unless it was infinitely long. She had already taught herself a little algebra and understood what this meant. In fact, there was an infinity of transcendental numbers. In more ways than one, pi was tied to infinity. She had caught a glimpse of something majestic. She saw through John Stoughton from the first. How her mother could even contemplate marrying him was a mystery, never mind that it was only 2 years after her father's death. He was nice enough looking, and he could pretend when he put his mind to it that he really cared about you. But he was a martinet, puffed up with self-importance. She was sure that as an associate professor of physics, he secretly despised her dead father, who had been only a shopkeeper. Stoughton had made it clear that an interest in radio and electronics was unseemly for a girl, that it would not catch her a husband, that understanding physics was for her a foolish and aberrational notion. It was pretentious. This was an objective fact that she might as well get used to. He was telling her for her own good. She'd thank him for it in later life. That her mother could truly love him was inconceivable. She needed someone to take care of her. Ellie vowed she would never accept a position of dependence. Ellie's father had died, her mother had grown distant, and Ellie felt herself exiled to the house of a tyrant. There was no one to call her Presh anymore. She longed to escape. Surrounding the blue-white star in its equatorial plane was a vast ring of orbiting debris. The world-sized polyhedron plummeted through a gap in the rings and emerged out the other side. In the ring plane, it had been intermittently shadowed by icy boulders and tumbling mountains. But now, carried along its trajectory toward a point above the opposite pole of the star, the sunlight gleamed off its millions of bowl-shaped appendages. If you looked very carefully, you might have seen one of them make a slight pointing adjustment. You would not have seen the burst of radio waves washing out from it into the depths of space. Ellie would look up at Venus and imagine it was a world something like the Earth. She would examine the night sky and scrutinize that unflickering bright point of light. Sometimes she could almost convince herself that she could really see it. A swirl of yellow fog would suddenly clear and a vast, jeweled city would briefly be revealed. She would imagine a young Venusian glancing up at a bright blue point of light in its sky, standing on tiptoe and wondering about the inhabitants of Earth. It was an irresistible notion. She'd half expected not to attend college, although she was determined to leave home. Stoughton would not pay for her to go anywhere but the community college where he taught. But Ellie had done spectacularly well on the standardized college entrance exams and accepted a scholarship to Harvard. She arrived for orientation period, a pretty, dark-haired young woman of middling height with a lopsided smile and an eagerness to learn everything. She set out to take as many courses as possible apart from her central interests in mathematics, physics, and engineering. But there was a problem with her central interests. She found it difficult to discuss physics, much less debate it, with her predominantly male classmates. There would be a slight pause, and then they would go on as if she'd not spoken. Occasionally, they would acknowledge her remark or even praise it, and then again continue undeflected. She was reasonably sure her remarks were not entirely foolish and did not wish to be ignored, much less ignored and patronized alternately. So she developed a physics voice, a professional voice, clear, competent, and loud. It was hard to continue long in such a voice, though, because she was sometimes in danger of bursting out laughing. And every time she found herself in a new group, she would have to fight her way through again just to dip her oar into the discussion. The boys were uniformly unaware that there was a problem. At the height of the sexual revolution, she experimented with gradually increasing enthusiasm, but found she was intimidating her would-be lovers. Her relationships tended to last a few months or less. The alternative seemed to be to disguise her interests and stifle her opinions. In the late 1960s, the Soviet Union succeeded in landing space vehicles on the surface of Venus, the first spacecraft of the human species to set down in working order on another planet. Over a decade earlier, American radio astronomers, confined to Earth, had discovered that Venus was an intense source of radio emission. The most popular explanation had been that the massive atmosphere of Venus trapped heat through a planetary greenhouse effect, and the surface of the planet was stifling hot. When the Soviets' Venera spacecraft confirmed that the temperature of the atmosphere of Venus was hot enough to melt lead, Ellie had to admire how powerful radio astronomy was. The astronomers had sat home, pointed their radio telescopes at Venus, and measured the surface temperature just about as accurately as the Venera probes did 13 years later. Ellie began to visit the university's modest radio telescope, eventually getting an invitation to help with the observations and the data analysis. She was accepted as a paid summer assistant at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, and found that the atmosphere of patient inquiry and the occasional rewards of modest discovery were agreeable to her. They were trying to measure how the number of distant extragalactic radio sources increased as they looked deeper into space. She began to think about better ways of detecting faint radio signals. In due course, she graduated cum laude from Harvard and went on for graduate work in radio astronomy at the California Institute of Technology. For a year, she apprenticed herself to David Drumlin. He had a worldwide reputation for brilliance, but was at heart one of those men you can find at the top of every profession who are in a state of unrelieved anxiety that someone, somewhere, might prove smarter than they. Drumlin taught Ellie some of the real heart of the subject, especially its theoretical underpinnings. She was too romantic, he would say. The universe is strictly ordered according to its own rules. The idea is to think as the universe does, not to foist our romantic predispositions and girlish longings on the universe. He was a man in excellent physical condition. Prematurely gray hair, sardonic smile, half-moon reading glasses perched toward the end of his nose, bow tie, square jaw, and remnants of a Montana twang. Other professors looked on graduate students as resources for the future, the intellectual torchbearers to the next generation. But to David Drumlin, graduate students were gunslingers. There was no telling which of them might at any moment challenge him. They were to be kept in their places. A stimulating afternoon for his graduate students would be for them to be invited over, in twos or threes, to drive him to the edge of a favorite cliff near Pacific Palisades. Casually attached to his hang glider, he would leap off the precipice toward the tranquil ocean a few hundred feet below. Their job was to drive down the coast road and retrieve him. It was quite a performance. In her second year at Caltech, Peter Valerian returned to campus from a sabbatical year abroad. He was a gentle and unprepossessing man. No one, least of all himself, considered him especially brilliant. Yet he had a steady record of significant accomplishment in radio astronomy because, he explained when pressed, he kept at it. There was one slightly disreputable aspect of his scientific career. He was fascinated by the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. Ellie loved to listen to him. It was like entering Wonderland or the Emerald City. Actually, it was better, because this could really be true, could really happen. But Valerian repeatedly stressed that speculation must be confronted with sober physical reality. The extraterrestrials and their technology had to conform strictly to the laws of nature. But what emerged from this scrutiny and survived the most skeptical physical and astronomical analysis might even be true. As a topic for her doctoral thesis, Ellie chose the development of an improvement in the sensitive receivers employed on radio telescopes. It made use of her talents in electronics, freed her from the mainly theoretical Drumlin, and permitted her to continue her discussions with Valerian, but without taking the professionally dangerous step of working with him on extraterrestrial intelligence. That was too speculative a subject for a doctoral dissertation. She was working on the ruby maser. A ruby is made mainly of alumina, which is almost perfectly transparent. The red color derives from a small chromium impurity distributed through the alumina crystal. When a strong magnetic field is impressed on the ruby,
the chromium atoms are raised to an excited state. She loved the image of all the little chromium atoms called to feverish activity in each amplifier, frenzied in a good practical cause, amplifying a weak radio signal. The stronger the magnetic field, the more excited the chromium atoms became. Thus, the maser could be tuned so that it was particularly sensitive to a selected radio frequency. She found a way to make rubies with lanthanide impurities in addition to the chromium atoms, so a maser could be tuned to a narrower frequency range and could detect a much weaker signal. She installed her new instrument, which had to be immersed in liquid helium, on one of Caltech's radio telescopes and detected at entirely new frequencies what astronomers call the 3-degree blackbody background radiation, the remnant in the radio spectrum of the immense explosion that began this universe, the Big Bang. "Let's see if I've got this right," she would say to herself. "I've taken an inert gas that's in the air, made it into a liquid, put some impurities into a ruby, attached a magnet, and detected the fires of creation." She would then shake her head in amazement. How would you explain this to the best scientists of 1,000 years ago, who knew about air and rubies and lodestones, but not about liquid helium, stimulated emission, and superconducting flux pumps? In fact, she reminded herself, they did not have even the foggiest notion about the radio spectrum, or even the idea of a spectrum, except, of course, for the rainbow. How could we hope to understand the science of a civilization 1,000 years ahead of us? After receiving her doctorate, Ellie accepted an appointment as research associate at the Arecibo Observatory, a great bowl 305 meters across, fixed to the floor of a karst valley in the foothills of northwestern Puerto Rico. With the largest radio telescope on the planet, she was eager to employ her maser detector to look at as many different astronomical objects as she could, nearby planets and stars, the center of the galaxy, pulsars and quasars. As a full-time member of the observatory staff, she would be assigned a significant amount of observing time. Access to the great radio telescopes is keenly competitive, there being many more worthwhile research projects than can possibly be accommodated. Reserved telescope time for the resident staff is a perquisite beyond price. For many of the astronomers, it was the only reason they would consent to live in such godforsaken places. She also hoped to examine a few nearby stars for possible signals of intelligent origin. With her detector system, it would be possible to hear the radio leakage from a planet even a few light years away. And an advanced society intending to communicate with us would doubtless be capable of much greater power transmissions than we are. When she thought carefully about it, she was surprised that in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, what could be done was so far ahead of what had been done. The resources that had been devoted to this question were trifling. Some months after Ellie arrived in Arecibo, Peter Valerian came to visit. Nominally, he was there to give a lecture, but she knew that part of his purpose was to check up on how she was doing and provide some psychological support. Her research had gone very well. She had discovered what seemed to be a new interstellar molecular cloud complex and had obtained some very fine, high-time-resolution data on the pulsar at the center of the Crab Nebula. She had even completed the most sensitive search yet for the signals from a few dozen nearby stars, but with no positive results. Look at enough stars, and sooner or later, terrestrial interference or the concatenation of random noise will produce a pattern that for a moment makes your heart palpitate. You calm down and check it out. If it doesn't repeat itself, you consider it spurious. This discipline was essential. She was determined to be as tough-minded as possible without abandoning the sense of wonder. They took a picnic lunch out along the very periphery of the bowl-shaped dish. Workmen repairing or replacing the panels could be seen in the distance, walking on special snowshoes so they did not tear the aluminum sheets and plunge through to the ground below. Valerian was delighted with her progress. They exchanged bits of gossip and current scientific tidbits. The conversation turned to SETI, as the search for extraterrestrial intelligence was beginning to be called. "Have you ever thought about doing it full-time, Ellie?" "I haven't thought about it much. That's not really possible, is it? There's no major facility devoted to SETI full-time anywhere in the world, as far as I know." "No, but there might be. There's a chance that dozens of additional dishes might be added to the very large array and make it into a dedicated SETI observatory. They'd do some of the usual kind of radio astronomy also, of course. It would be a superb interferometer. It's only a possibility. It's expensive. It needs real political will, and it's years away at best. Just something to think about. Peter, don't you have the sense that if they're anywhere, they're everywhere? If really advanced guys live 1,000 light-years away, shouldn't they have an outpost in our backyard? You could do the SETI thing forever, you know, and never convince yourself that you completed the search. Ah, you're beginning to sound like Dave Drumlin. If we can't find them in his lifetime, he's not interested. We're just beginning, SETI. You know how many possibilities there are. This is the first time when anybody's been able to look for extraterrestrial intelligence. Nobody's guaranteeing success. But can you think of a more important question? Imagine them out there, sending us signals, and nobody on Earth is listening. That would be a joke, a travesty. Wouldn't you be ashamed of your civilization if we were able to listen and didn't have the gumption to do it? Ellie thought about that. What worries me the most is the opposite. The possibility that they're not trying. They could communicate with us, all right, but they're not doing it because they don't see any point to it. It's like... She glanced down at her picnic tablecloth. It's like the ants. They occupy the same landscape that we do. Well, we don't try to communicate with them. I don't think they have the foggiest notion that we exist. The pulses had been journeying for years through the great dark between the stars. Occasionally, they would intercept an irregular cloud of gas and dust, and a little of the energy would be absorbed as scattered. The remainder continued in the original direction. Ahead of them was a faint yellow glow, slowly increasing in brightness among the other unvarying lights. Now, although to human eyes it would still be a point, it was by far the brightest object in the black sky. The pulses were encountering a horde of giant snowballs. Entering the Project Argus administration building near Socorro, New Mexico, the director was a willowy woman in her late 30s. Her eyes, large and set far apart, softened the angular bone structure of her face. Her long dark hair was loosely gathered at the nape of her neck. Walking into the control room, Ellie reassured herself that everything was in order. Through the window, she could see a few of the 131 radio telescopes that stretched for tens of kilometers across the New Mexico scrub desert, like some strange species of mechanical flower straining toward the sky. It was early afternoon, and she had been up late the night before. Radio astronomy can be performed during daylight because the air does not scatter radio waves from the sun as it does ordinary visible light. To a radio telescope pointing anywhere but very close to the sun, the sky is pitch black, except for the radio sources. Beyond the Earth's atmosphere, on the other side of the sky, is a universe teeming with radio emission. By studying radio waves, you can learn about planets and stars and galaxies, about the composition of great clouds of organic molecules that drift between the stars, about the origin and evolution and fate of the universe. But all of these radio emissions are natural, caused by physical processes, electrons spiraling in the galactic magnetic field, or interstellar molecules colliding with one another, or the remote echoes of the Big Bang. Red shifted from gamma rays at the origin of the universe to the tame and chill radio waves that fill all of space in our epoch. In the scant few decades in which humans have pursued radio astronomy, there has never been a real signal from the depths of space, something manufactured, something artificial, something contrived by an alien mind. There have been false alarms. The regular time variation of the radio emission from quasars, and especially pulsars, had at first been thought, tentatively, tremulously, to be a kind of announcement signal from someone else, or perhaps a radio navigation beacon for exotic ships that plied the spaces between the stars. But they'd turned out to be something else, perhaps equally exotic. Quasars seem to be stupendous sources of energy, perhaps connected with massive black holes at the centers of our galaxies, many of them observed more than halfway back in time to the origin of the universe. Pulsars are rapidly spinning atomic nuclei the size of a city. And there had been other rich and mysterious messages that had turned out to be intelligent after a fashion, but not very extraterrestrial.
The skies were now peppered with secret military radar systems and radio communication satellites. And yet the origin of life now seemed to be so easy. And there were so many planetary systems, so many worlds, and so many billions of years available for biological evolution, that it was hard to believe the galaxy was not teeming with life and intelligence. Project Argus was the largest facility in the world dedicated to the radio search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Radio waves traveled with the speed of light. They were easy to generate and easy to detect. Even very backward technological civilizations would stumble on radio early in their exploration of the physical world. Even now, only a few decades after the invention of the radio telescope, it was nearly possible, theoretically, to communicate with an identical civilization at the center of the galaxy. But there were so many places in the sky to examine and so many frequencies on which an alien civilization might be broadcasting that it required a systematic and patient observing program. Argus had been in full operation for more than 4 years. There had been glitches, intimations, false alarms, but no message. All 131 telescopes of Project Argus were controlled by computers. The system slowly scanned the sky on its own, checking that there were no mechanical or electronic breakdowns, comparing the data from different elements of the array. Ellie glanced at the billion-channel analyzer, a bank of electronics covering a whole wall, and at the visual display of the spectrometer. There was not really very much for the astronomers and technicians to do as the telescope array over the years slowly scanned the sky. If it detected something of interest, it would sound an alarm. Then the Argus project would go into high gear to determine if this one was an instrument failure or some American or Russian space bogey. Even without the false alarms, Ellie was constantly busy. Together with the engineering staff, she devised ways of improving the sensitivity of the equipment. She delegated some of the radio telescopes to examine exotic astronomical objects that had been recently detected by other observatories. She helped staff members and visitors with projects unrelated to SETI. She flew to Washington to keep interest high at the funding agency, the National Science Foundation. She gave public talks on Project Argus and occasionally greeted an enterprising reporter. She had to take care that the tedium did not engulf her. Her co-workers were pleasant enough, but even apart from the impropriety of a close personal relationship with a nominal subordinate, she did not find herself tempted into any real intimacies. There had been a few brief, torrid, but fundamentally casual relationships with local men unconnected with the Argus project. She sat down before one of the consoles and plugged in the earphones. It was futile, she knew, a conceit to think that she, listening on one or two channels, would detect a pattern, when the vast computer system monitoring a billion channels had not. But it gave her a modest illusion of utility. She leaned back, eyes half closed. She heard, as always, a kind of static, a continuous, echoing, random noise. Once she had felt she heard a kind of singing, fading tantalizingly in and out, lying just beyond her ability to convince herself that there was something really there. It was in the area of the sky, containing the star toward which the Voyager 1 spacecraft carried, a golden phonograph record on which were impressed greetings, pictures, and songs from Earth. Could they be sending us their music at the speed of light, while we are sending ours to them only 1/10,000th as fast? At other times, when the static was clearly patternless, she would remind herself of the famous dictum in information theory that the most efficiently coded message was indistinguishable from noise unless you had the key to the encoding. There were a billion channels to choose from. You could spend your life trying to outguess the computer, listening with pathetically limited human ears and brains seeking a pattern. Humans are good, she knew, at discerning subtle patterns that are really there, but equally so at imagining them when they are altogether absent. Some sequence of pulses, some configuration of the static that would, for an instant, give a syncopated beat or a brief melody. She returned to the sky survey mode. It was like a musician listening to the rumble of a distant thunderstorm. The occasional small patches of pattern would pursue her and intrude themselves into her memory. She was, she would admit to herself ruefully, being haunted by the charged particles and magnetic fields of the cold, thin gas between the flickering distant stars. Dr. Arroway. She blinked, removed the headphones, and gave the technician a small, apologetic smile. Sorry, I must have drifted off.
It's Dr. Drumlin on the phone. He says he has an appointment with you. Holy smoke, I forgot.
As the years had passed since she had served briefly as his graduate student at Caltech, David Drumlin had become increasingly convinced that extraterrestrials did not exist, or at least that they were too rare, too distant to be detected. He had come to Argus to give the weekly scientific colloquium, but he had come for another purpose as well. He had written a letter to the National Science Foundation urging that Argus terminate its search for extraterrestrial intelligence and devote itself full-time to more conventional radio astronomy. He gave her a copy of the letter.
But Dave, we've only been at it for 4.5 years. We've looked at less than a third of the northern sky. This is the first survey that can do the entire radio noise minimum at optimum bandpasses. Why would you want to stop now?
No, Ellie, this is endless. After 12 years, you'll find no sign of anything. You'll argue that another Argus facility has to be built at a cost of hundreds of millions of dollars in Australia or Argentina to observe the southern sky. And when that fails, you'll talk about building some paraboloid with a free-flying feed in Earth orbit so you can get millimeter waves. You'll always be able to think of some kind of observation that hasn't been done. You'll always invent some explanation about why the extraterrestrials like to broadcast where we haven't looked.
Ah, Dave, we've been through this 100 times. If we fail, we learn something of the rarity of intelligent life, or at least of intelligent life that thinks like we do and wants to communicate with backward civilizations like us. And if we succeed, we hit the cosmic jackpot. There's no greater discovery that you can imagine.
Ellie, there are first-rate projects that aren't finding telescope time. There's work on quasar evolution, binary pulsars, the chromospheres of nearby stars, even those crazy interstellar proteins. These projects are waiting in line because this facility, by far the best phased array in the world, is being used almost entirely for SETI. 75% for SETI, Dave, 25% for routine radio astronomy.
Don't call it routine. And we've got the opportunity to look back to the time that the galaxies were being formed, or maybe even earlier than that. We can examine the cores of giant molecular clouds and the black holes at the centers of galaxies. There is a revolution in astronomy about to happen, and you are standing in the way. Dave, try not to personalize this. Argus would never have been built if there wasn't public support for SETI. The idea for Argus isn't mine. The National Science Foundation is entirely behind...
Not entirely. And if I have anything to say about it...
This is grandstanding. This is pandering to UFO kooks and comic strips and weak-minded adolescents.
Drumlin's impatience with Argus, she knew, was shared by many astronomers. After the first 2 years, a kind of melancholy had pervaded the facility. There were passionate debates in the commissary or during the long and undemanding watches about the intentions of the putative extraterrestrials. It was hard enough to guess the intentions of our elected representatives in Washington. What would the intentions be of fundamentally different kinds of beings on physically different worlds, hundreds or thousands of light years away? Some believed that the signal would not be transmitted in the radio spectrum at all, but in the infrared, or the visible, or somewhere among the gamma rays. Or perhaps the extraterrestrials were signaling avidly, but with a technology we would not invent for 1,000 years. Astronomers at other institutions were making extraordinary discoveries among the stars and galaxies. Other radio astronomers published scientific papers, attended meetings, were uplifted by a sense of progress and purpose. The Argus astronomers tended not to publish, and were usually ignored when the call went out for invited papers at the annual meeting of the American Astronomical Society, or the triennial symposia and plenary sessions of the International Astronomical Union. So in consultation with the National Science Foundation, the leadership at Argus had reserved 25% of the observing time for projects unconnected to SETI. Some important discoveries had been made on the extragalactic objects that seem paradoxically to be moving faster than light, on the surface temperature of Neptune's big moon, Triton, and on the dark matter in the outer reaches of nearby galaxies where no stars could be seen. Morale began to improve. The Argus staff felt they were making a contribution at the cutting edge of astronomical discovery. The time to complete a full search of the sky had been lengthened, it was true, but now their professional careers had some safety net. They might not succeed in finding signs of other intelligent beings, but they might pluck other secrets from the treasury of nature. However, there were many who agreed with Drumlin. They looked longingly at the miracle that Argus's 131 radio telescopes represented and imagined using them for their own, doubtless meritorious programs. She was alternately conciliatory and argumentative with Dave, but none of it did any good. Drumlin's colloquium was in part an attempt to demonstrate that there were no extraterrestrials anywhere.
If we had accomplished so much in only a few thousand years of high technology, what must a truly advanced species be capable of? And yet, in all of astronomy, there was no sign of a phenomenon that could not be understood by natural processes, for which an appeal to extraterrestrial intelligence had to be made. Why hadn't Argus detected a radio signal by now? Did they imagine just one radio transmitter in all of the sky? Did they realize how many billions of stars they had examined already? The experiment was a worthy one, but now it was over. They didn't have to examine the rest of the sky. The answer was in. Neither in deepest space nor near the Earth was there any sign of extraterrestrials. They did not exist. To clear her head, it was her practice to go for long solo drives in her one extravagance, a carefully maintained 1957 Thunderbird with removable hardtop. This time she drove southeast toward the Sacramento Mountains. Could Dave be right? Was it true that no matter how many years went by without the receipt of a message, the project would continue, continually devising novel and expensive instrumentation? What would be a convincing sign of failure? When would she be willing to give up? The whine of her tires on the highway was a kind of white noise, and she found that, involuntarily, she was listening for a pattern. She had taken to listening closely to many sources of white noise. The motor of the refrigerator, the water running for her bath, the washing machine, the roar of the ocean during a brief scuba diving trip to Cozumel. She would listen to these everyday sources of random noise and try to determine whether there were fewer apparent patterns in them than in the interstellar static. What if an interstellar message were being received by Project Argus, but very slowly, one bit of information every hour, say, or every week, or every decade? Suppose they lived for thousands of years and talked very slowly. The opposite was possible as well. The fast talkers, manic little creatures, perhaps, who transmitted a complete radio message, the equivalent of hundreds of pages of English text, in a nanosecond. She was troubled that in their haste to do a full sky survey in less than a human lifetime, to listen to all of the sky at a billion frequencies, that they had abandoned both the frantic talkers and the laconic plotters. But surely they would know better than we what modulation frequencies were acceptable. If they wanted to communicate with us, they would make it easy for us. They would send signals at many different frequencies. They would use many different modulation timescales. So why had we received no signal? Could Dave possibly be right? All those billions of worlds going to waste, lifeless, barren? Intelligent beings growing up only in this obscure corner of an incomprehensibly vast universe? No matter how valiantly she tried, Ellie couldn't make herself take such a possibility seriously. It dovetailed perfectly with human fears and pretensions. We wanted to believe it too badly. Wait a minute, she thought. We haven't even examined the northern skies once with the Argus system. In another 7 or 8 years, if we've still heard nothing, that'll be the time to start worrying.